Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We'll be taking on two big issues this morning on the show. In the 10 o'clock hour, Interim Corrections Commissioner James Baker will join me to discuss the many challenges that his department is facing from the recent death of a prisoner, COVID concerns in the prisons, and staffing considerations. This hour, we're going to take a thorough look at the state's slaughtering and meat processing capacity and oversight. Joining us to discuss this topic are two representatives from the Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. Julie Beauvert is the meat program section chief. Julie, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
And Abby Willard is Agricultural Development Division Director, and thank you as well, Abby.
You're welcome. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Listeners, if you have questions about slaughtering and meat processing, you can give us a call at 244-1777. You can also call 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. If you're a farmer or a consumer, we welcome your questions or comments. You can also email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Abby, I'll start with you. Tell us how demand for local meat products spiked during the pandemic.
It did. So that's an important message, I think, to get out there both to consumers and to meat producers, that when the pandemic struck Vermont, there were some really interesting consumer habits and shifts that occurred. So people were shopping less often, but buying larger purchases. There was, you know, even some moments of hoarding of food. Mm-hmm. People were preparing more comfort food. So they were cooking more at home. At the very beginning of the pandemic, everyone's kids were home from college or grade school. Schools were closed. So there was an increase in dairy and meat product consumption. And people had limited locations where they could purchase food. So there was I think early after the beginning of the pandemic, there was a 50% increase in retail grocery store sales as people were looking for a more convenient and safe place to buy food. We also saw growth in direct-to-consumer sales. So people were buying directly from farms. And so that meant they were looking for, you know, curbside or online ordering, a way to support their local farms and provide a reliable food source for their families. And so we saw an increase of meat sales occur in both of those locations.
Pre-pandemic, Abby, had we been seeing demand for Vermont meat already rising?
Yeah, I think one of the benefits of being both a producer and a food business in Vermont is that there's a lot of pride in Vermont products, and the consumers generally have been supportive of supporting businesses that grow local food, provide local products, and make those available in the community. So I think Vermont's always had a high demand for local products. And during the pandemic, we just saw that really increase. And there's some really interesting long-term trends as a result of that as well.
Short term, right as the pandemic hit, didn't our meat producers take a bit of a hit when restaurants and institutions were closed?
It did, and that really speaks to how Vermont businesses have been successful during this pandemic response and recovery time. Businesses that were diversified had a variety of markets, so say institutional markets closed, but they still went to a farmer's market, or their retail or their, you know, their restaurant closed, but they still had a farm stand. So we saw many businesses make really rapid pivots to be able to pick up market losses for those that had closed some of the other avenues that they had. And we saw restaurants, we saw retail really start to purchase from more local producers in a way to respond to the growing demand. And again, we saw a lot of on-farm sales increase as a result.
Julie Beauvert, as this demand for locally raised meat grew, what effect did it have on Vermont slaughterhouses and meat processors?
Yeah, so it had a tremendous effect on all of our slaughter industry. It got to such a big demand that they just couldn't keep up with what was going on. Many people were starting to raise their own animals, grow their own food, and so kind of like going back to the land and being able to produce the product. But unfortunately, a lot of them didn't have a plan in place, and so struggling to try to find resources out there to be able to handle and take these animals in to be able to slaughter them under inspection, to give them the opportunity to be able to sell this product to consumers was an extremely difficult time. Our slaughter facilities were so they were so busy, and they had to like say no to so many folks out there hard enough because they just couldn't keep up with the slaughter. And of course, slaughtering also goes into processing, which again is a huge process to be able to take these carcass, the meat from the carcass, and be able to put individual cuts for the consumer to be able to take to the farmer's market or to a store, or even primal to be able to sell to restaurants. And then we saw the restaurants go, and then they diversified into more of a retail setting. Still, it just was the hard demand on the processing part, which just, you know, just took a huge hit for our industry.
Well, Julie, before this crush that was brought on by the pandemic, were the local places, the slaughterhouses, the meat processors, were they able to handle the demand that was in place at that time?
Well, they seem to be able to handle the demand fine. You know, whenever anybody new comes into the state or anybody new decides that they are going to start raising their own animals, it's best to have a plan in place. Best to, before you even start a process like this, call a slaughterhouse, call it, find out what their availability is. Because what I have seen, even before and during the pandemic, is people have called and say, hey, you know, I've got a beef, I need to get slaughtered, what do I do? And so it's really good to have a good business plan ahead of time and to be able to talk to the industry. They're willing to help. They just really need to, have some notice, because they do have people that they've had for years that they take care of, and they do try to fit more and more people in. But the problem is, you know, we only have so many slaughterhouses that are able to fill the capacity.
How many do we have, Julie?
Well, right now we have 7 USDA federal slaughterhouses and 2 states. So that's not a lot.
No, it doesn't seem to be a lot.
No, especially through COVID. We've had some inquiries with people that want to come into this industry. Working through, we have one new one in the southern part of the state that is currently conducting custom exempt slaughter and processing, and hoping to become USDA hopefully by the spring of next year. We have another one that slaughterhouse is being built right now, but you know, because of COVID, it's been set back quite a bit because of trying to get supplies, trying to get electricians, plumbers, you name it. It's a number of things that is slowing this process down.
Abby Willard, why do Vermonters have this trust for the locally raised and processed meat?
Yeah, I think that speaks to the entrepreneurs of this state that have continued to raise healthy animals, process beautiful product, and continuously make it available in a variety of market channels for both consumers in the state and beyond. So it's really a tribute to both the production practices and I think the ethics of our meat producers and processors to continuously have high quality products that kind of encompass integrity and quality. And that brand is what Vermont's been known for a long time, and it's our kind of goal and objective to keep it that way.
Julie, I want to get into the slaughtering and processing side of things for a bit. First of all, you know, what are the differences between slaughtering and processing?
So slaughtering is the actual act of killing an animal for human food. So that's the whole part of slaughter. But then the meat processing is the actual preparation of the meat for human consumption. So, and a lot of that processing can stem to a variety of different products. It could be like a simple ground product. It could be a simple individual cut, or it could go into a complex processing such as hams or bacon, summer sausage, even a jerky product. So things like that. And any time you get into a more complex processing, it takes time. And it takes different food safety regulations in order to actually process the product.
Can someone do both? Are there operations that are both slaughtering and processing?
Yes. All of our slaughter facilities do both. They don't always do the complex, but they do anything from sausage to ground to individual cuts. We have some that do have a smokehouse, so they will smoke meats. So that's kind of like the gist of most of our the slaughter and processing facilities. And then we have other just processing facilities that will do more of the, you know, the more interesting, well, I shouldn't say interesting, but the more complex processing, like I said before. Yes, because we are even seeing the state coming into more specialty items like charcuterie. So that's a huge thing that's now coming into our state.
Julie Beauvair, let's look at the agency's oversight of slaughtering in Vermont. What does that entail?
So we have food safety specialists that are trained, and actually, let me just go back a bit. So we, the USDA Secretary of Agriculture allows our state program to be able to go out and inspect as long as we stay equal to. So we follow the same guidelines as USDA. Mm-hmm. So our staff are fully trained. And when they are going out to a slaughter facility, they are at that slaughter facility the whole time that they are operating and slaughtering an animal. So basically, the slaughter establishments cannot operate unless inspection personnel are present. Okay, so if they're working an 8-hour day plus overtime, our inspectors have to be there. And we give them that 8 hours. We allow them an operational hours of 8 per day. And our inspectors go out there and we give that to it, no cost to them.
Now, you said there's 7 USDA and 2 state slaughterhouses. Do you also inspect the USDA facilities or just the state facilities?
We actually, we are trained to inspect all the facilities because, like I said, we are equal to USDA. We're trained, our inspectors are trained the same as federal inspectors. And so we go out and we will inspect those as well. And we actually do quite a few of them. We act as more of a relief inspector for a lot of the federal inspectors that are out there. So, and we do have some establishments that the feds right now are a bit shorthanded on inspectors. So we have taken a lot of them as a full-time basis.
Do we have the requisite number of inspectors in the state, in your department, to be present?
We have 10. We have 10 inspectors right now, but that also stems to a supervisor, 2 compliance officers, and 1 enforcement investigation analysis officer. But they're all trained to be able to do all the requirements is what we say in food safety specialists 1 and 2. So, yes, and they're all, and throughout COVID, including myself, have been out there helping and doing the inspections as needed because we have been essential workers right from day one.
Yeah. Well, Abby, we talked about the demand for the meat, you know, that as COVID started, the pandemic started, you know, the demand for local meats jumped. Has that demand remained high now as we're, 10 months into the pandemic?
I would say that it has, Rick, and we have done some really interesting surveys of farm and food businesses in a partnership with a research team led by Meredith Niles at the University of Vermont. And we were looking at the impacts on businesses and saw that about 44% of the businesses surveyed have seen a loss of sales, and that's generally due to market closures. But 14% of businesses that we surveyed saw an increase in sales. And every farm that saw an increase in sales had some animal products as part of their their product offerings. So that was either meat or chicken, eggs, could be beef. So really interesting to acknowledge that farms that are actually seeing an increase in sales, it's directly tied to having meat and animal products. So that's indicating that even this is survey results from the summer and early fall. So even as we kind of are, 6 to 9 months into this pandemic, there's still demand for local meats. And I think it speaks to actually some of the pieces that Julie and her team are responsible for, both building confidence in a local supply chain and sort of ensuring that we have producers that continue to have some degree of access into processing and then are getting that product into the marketplace. We have a lot more control over a local meat supply than we do finding out that meat processing plants in the Midwest have closed because they have hundreds of COVID cases. So I think consumers are really both supportive of the local businesses and the supply chain, but also feel, I think, a bit more empowered and more confident in supporting local during this time.
I don't know if you have data yet that looks at this, but do you think people will, now that they have found this local meat supply and, are going to it, is this something that we think will continue into the next year and after the pandemic is finally complete and over? We've got the vaccine and we're moving on.
I know. Yeah, that is the million-dollar question, and I think I can probably do our best to answer that question by some of the survey questions that we did ask of our farm and food businesses. So it's easier to kind of survey that population than kind of the average consumer.
Right.
What we learned was that 2/3 of our surveyed farm and food businesses made changes as a result of the pandemic. And those changes to their business models were typically around selling to different markets. They obviously made some food safety changes in their operation, and they looked at different distribution mechanisms of getting product to the market. When we asked them if, first off, how long they thought these changes would be in effect, they're saying at least 1 to 2 years based upon the kind of cumulative impact of the pandemic. But they also said that post-pandemic, majority of these businesses anticipate the same level of sales through these new channels. So if they increased direct-to-consumer sales, if they increased retail grocery sales, they expect that those sales will stay at the same level post-pandemic. So at least on the producer side, they're anticipating that they're going to continue to see a similar demand of the mechanisms that they've been using in the last 9 months to get product to their customers.
I'm thinking of Von Trapp's here in Waitsfield that opened their own farm store maybe a month ago. And in addition to their cheeses, they have their own meats there available and then other Vermont products. Are we seeing more of that happening around the state, Abby?
Yeah, right after the pandemic hit, it happened to be, obviously in the spring, and then we had the growing season and the summer kind of market season. We saw a lot of infrastructure investments. We saw some interesting trends. We saw some infrastructure investments by businesses to say, if we're able to do on-farm sales, we may need to build a farm stand or expand out this sort of vision that we wanted to do on-farm sales. We also saw businesses look at online digital marketing and e-commerce. So we saw many, many businesses find a way to engage consumers through a digital platform that they may have had a website previously, but they probably didn't have e-commerce sales opportunities, and many businesses sort of developed that capacity.
Julie Bover, I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Keep going, Abby.
One last thing, Rick.
Yeah, please.
One last thing that we did see that was a really positive piece was a lot of business-to-business relationships. So even if a particular farm wasn't interested in setting up a farm stand or starting to do e-commerce, they were connecting with another farm in their community or a neighbor that already had a farm stand and making their product available. So that was a really positive partnerships that we saw a bunch of during the pandemic.
These are positive trends. Great to hear about those. Julie, what does it take to get approval to open a slaughterhouse in Vermont?
So that's a really good question, but it's really hard for me to answer like in 2 minutes. But I can kind of give you the gist of it. Basically, anybody that does or is interested in opening up a slaughterhouse or even a processing facility, to please get a hold of me and get a hold of the agency, and we can give them further details. But a couple of things that I can kind of go over, one of the more important things is things that people don't realize is when they are building their structure, they want to make sure that they're in an area that they can have an approved water source. And what I mean by that is having a letter either from a municipality if they're on municipal water systems, such as in, you know, city, the county, or public water. So just giving us a letter of approval for that. If they're not, if they have such a private water supply, such as a well water or a spring, then those are a little bit more difficult, and they would need to be tested twice a year for potability to make sure the water is safe. The other things are really for regulatory. We ask for pest control management. We want to make sure you have adequate lighting, ventilation, walls and floors and ceilings must be made of such materials that are easy to be sanitized. And I say this because that is the key thing is sanitation whenever you're building a facility. And the other biggest thing that I really want to express is a food safety plan known as HACCP, which is a hazard analysis critical control point. That is probably the biggest part of whenever you're opening up any kind of facility at all. We need to make sure that you have a structured food safety program in place, which starts at the flow of your process. It has steps to control any hazards you deem reasonably likely that could occur during any type of that process. Again, this could be very, hard for people to understand at this point. So, again, I stress that anybody who's interested in this to please call because we can give them the technical and regulatory guidance to help and work you through this. And it's not as difficult as someone might seem because we here at the agency strive to be able to help people and guide them through the process right from day one.
We're discussing slaughtering and processing of meat in Vermont. Abby Willard and Julie Beauvais from the Agency of Ag are with us up till 10 o'clock, so stay with us. We're going to take a break for this CBS News update here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. We're spending the hour discussing meat processing and slaughtering in Vermont with Abby Willard and Julie Beauvais of the Agency of Agriculture, Food, and Markets. We're talking about consumer demand, regulations, oversight, and job development. If you'd like to ask a question or share a comment about any of these topics, whether you raise livestock or purchase Vermont-raised meat, you can call us at 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Before the break, Julie, we were talking about getting approval to open up a slaughterhouse in Vermont, and I wanted to ask you about what help you provide, that your department provides, in someone who's looking to open up an operation, getting it approved and up and running.
Sure. So the first thing we do is the people that are interested in doing this, they give us a call, and we kind of go through step-by-step on what is needed to be able to do this. Once they decide that they want to go ahead and, build this facility, or maybe they already have an existing facility that they're going to be using, we actually go there. We actually go on site and talk to them and take a look at their production or their facility, what may need to be done, what may need to be fixed, and kind of walk them through that. So we're there kind of like, on site to help them. And then, like I said before about the food safety program, that's another thing. We sit down with them and we kind of explain what we mean by the food safety. We give them, emails on where they can go and get trained to become HACCP trained. And it's a criteria that we ask for, whether or not they want to actually go to a class or if they want to do something online. But we do ask that somebody in that facility is HACCP trained. And so we do a lot of hands-on. And we feel that this is needed, and it's a better resource for a lot of folks out there that just don't know where to start. And I think it winds up being just extremely beneficial and helpful to all of us, because not only them getting the resources and guidelines from us, but also us knowing what they are going to do going forward and know that we have that communication going.
Julie, you've mentioned a few times that they should call you to get this started, so this is probably a great time to give a phone number.
So they can always call me at 802, I can't remember my number right now. You know what? Go ahead and send it to me by email. It's julie.bovaire@vermont.gov.
Okay, and Bovaire is?
Our actual meat inspection line is 828-2426. So that's the main line that they can call, and then they will automatically get brought over to me.
Okay, good. I knew that would probably throw you. We don't remember our phone numbers as well as we used to. I'm going
to
switch.
I have to write it down.
I know. I have it written all over the place, the numbers I give out for people to call in, 244-1777, 877-291-8255, because it's right in front of me on a big sign, Julie. So fear. I'm going to switch it up just a little. I'd like you to tell me about on-farm slaughter, when that can be done, who does it, and how that meat can be used.
Okay. So on-farm slaughter is really – so basically we have exemption from inspection, and on-farm slaughter is one of them. We also have a personal use exemption, and this is for anybody that has an animal or has – poultry or anything on their farm, and they've raised that animal for themselves, for their personal use to be able to have, you know, for food consumption. They are able to slaughter and process those animals however they want. That is their personal use. So we don't go out, we don't inspect, we don't do anything when it comes to that. The on-farm slaughter is a little bit different, because this has to do with people that want to go to a farm and actually purchase a live animal from the farmer. Mm. So when this person does that, and it can be more than one person, okay? So it can be persons 1, 2, 3, 4. It can be a number of people that can purchase this animal. At this point, the farmer has sold that animal live to these people or this one person. It is up to them now to have that animal slaughtered and processed. They can get an itinerant slaughterer, come to that farm. They can either take that animal to a custom or a facility to have it slaughtered if they can get in. Or if it's going to be for personal use, for their family, guests, non-paying guests, they can have the itinerant slaughter that animal on the farm. They can quarter it for easy transfer to a custom exempt facility to be processed into individual cuts for the people that have bought that animal. So that's basically the way on farm slaughter works.
Do we have many itinerant slaughterers here in the state?
We have many. But we don't know who they are. So the reason being is because they don't need to be licensed for
right.
us. We don't have a list of them. There are people out there that know them. They don't want to share their names because they have them. You know, I've heard this from a few people. And that's fine. Some people do. I do offhand know of a couple, which I'm not going to tell you their names on the air, but, they're just out there providing this service.
Gotcha. Abby Willard, does the state have any programs for people who are interested in getting into the slaughtering business and learning these job skills?
That's a great question. So I actually looked up sort of just to see what the job market is in animal slaughter and processing in Vermont. And it's a little bit old data because we use federal census data. So in 2016... there were 36 animal slaughter and processing facilities in the state, and there were 245 jobs, and that was up 40% from 5 years ago.
Wow.
When there were 147 jobs at fewer facilities in 2011. So we have seen a growth in the last decade in the number of jobs available and number of processing facilities doing meat slaughter and processing. So that's a good sign. We're also learning that those workers are generally making $16 to $18 an hour, and I'm sure there's certain circumstances where they're making more than that or possibly less, but you know, that's sort of the range of kind of job opportunity there. And yet, as we've talked about on the show and we've been in conversations for many months now, that's still not sufficient. There's still an increased demand for more meat processing than we have current capacity for due to the pandemic and due to an increase in desire for local meat. So we're all kind of quickly looking at opportunities to help expand production. And I think the Agency of Agriculture has a variety of funding opportunities to support slaughter facilities. So we did support slaughter and processing facilities with some of our coronavirus relief funds. So this was to cover losses or additional costs due to the pandemic, but specifically targeting support towards that industry. We have grant programs that help slaughter and processing facilities expand or diversify, you know, either add an additional line or be able to begin work with a different animal group, for example. Add new processing or packaging equipment. And then we've started conversations both around the education side, both with the Department of Labor and with Vermont Technical College, to see how we can help build out a greater skilled workforce in this field.
That's a brilliant idea. And I want to ask you, Julie, a little bit about processing. We've focused a lot on slaughtering. So first of all, with processing, what kind of oversight does your office have in that area? I think you need to bring my guests back in. Okay. Julie, I think you were cut off. So in processing, what kind of oversight do you have in that area?
Okay. Can you hear me?
We can now. Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. So earlier I talked about the HACCP program, which is a food safety program. So with processing, it gives the processors an ability to have this food safety program. So with our inspectors, because we focus mostly on our slaughter facilities to be there for an 8-hour day, the other assignments going into processing, we would usually have an inspector probably cover a couple of assignments each day, meaning they would not be there the total of 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the food safety system, they are able to go in there and to verify that the establishment is following that food safety system. And so they're checking their records and they're checking their temperatures and they're checking whatever is a part of that system. To be able to go in and to assure that the product that is being processed that day is safe and wholesome to be able to go out to the consumer. So it really alleviates an 8-hour day for the inspector. It's not command and control. It's actually now it's up to the establishments to know what their food safety system is and to be able to follow that system on a daily basis.
We've got Dave on the line calling from Plainfield. Let's take that call. Dave, thanks for joining Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, good morning, folks. Well, there's a lot of issues here. First, I would like to remind you that in 97, Ruth Wire, I remember her 20 years ago, she was constantly talking about the slaughterhouse issue, and in fact, there was only six slaughterhouses in the state, and how are we supposed to have a rural economy? What happened here, to remember, I came here in 74, and I'm 71 years old. Anyway, the boys told me, like, here in Plainfield, we have a place, the Lair's Carpet Barn. That was a slaughterhouse in the late 60s in, like, 1970. What happened was the feds came in, and Donald told me the story where they came in and said, we're federal inspectors. We want to see your books. And, you know, Donald could barely read and write his own name, and he had books. There was nothing. I mean, they just went around. And they just closed that place. And the place that I worked at was down on Route 14. It closed in 97. It was run by a fellow named Jeff Nichols, who moved the operation to Rutland. And it was about a mile past Hannaford's on the right. But I learned a lot from Jeff. Boy, Jeff was a Vermonter. The thing is, there's a lot of issues here. The first issue is, I don't know if it's still going on, but I know people in, there was a slaughterhouse down below Windsor. There was a smokehouse that we'd meet at, and a little slaughterhouse near there in Windsor. And there were people shipping their pigs from Plainfield down to Windsor, mm-hmm. and they'd have to wait maybe 4 or 5 days sometimes before the pigs, there was a problem. They would not get slaughtered right away. And also people here shipping their cows and other critters from this area up to up to Orleans County, like the Troy and places.
Right.
So the thing is, where are you going to learn how to do what Jeff does in the slaughterhouse, and I'll, you know, the whole thing of killing the cow. I'll tell you what.
Well, Dave, let me get to that.
Most people, if they had to kill a cow and make the hamburger, they wouldn't eat it.
I got you.
So there's a lot of issues here, and I've seen a lot of this, but that's just summing it up. It's still the same situation.
Dave, I'm going to ask you to just give our guests a chance to address this, because we're almost out of time. I do appreciate you calling. You know, this weight and having to ship the meat to, you know, an area away from where you live, who wants to take that? Is that still what we're facing? Are we still, even with 9 slaughterhouses, you know, are we still short of what we need here in the state?
So, Rick, Abby, I can start answering this question, and I understand exactly what he's talking about. We are having, and it's through COVID too, but even before that, we just don't have enough slaughterhouses in Vermont. And it is hard for people to be able to transport their animals locally. Some can, depending on where they live. Some can't because we just don't have enough slaughterhouses. And I hear that quite often. And so I recommend anybody that would like to get something up and running and started to please contact the Agency of Agriculture, contact Meat Inspection, and we will help them try to get something up and running. And like I said earlier, when you do have animals, make sure you have a plan in place beforehand. Make sure you know where these animals are going to go, so you don't have these kind of problems that we just heard from. And I know, of course, I know we will always have certain problems going forward, but we try to work through them and try to see what we can do to help these local folks out.
And Abby Willard, does this, you know, these lack of facilities in the state, does this prevent, you know, our farmers, our meat raisers to expand, to do more of what they want to do?
Yeah, I think we have both a infrastructure challenge at the processing facility and at the production and kind of animal raising side. So, you know, as local agriculture continues to expand and grow, there are a variety of opportunities to help both the industries and the businesses be more successful. And I think one of the pieces that I'm kind of thinking about most recently is, how do we help create a career pathway for our meat slaughter and processing industries? And I think if we can look at opportunities for some on-job training and career advancement and real promotion and recruitment of developing a more skilled labor force for slaughter and processing, in turn, we will create more capacity and more kind of appeal for those businesses to either expand or new entrepreneurs to enter the field. And I think once we're able to do that, then we have some infrastructure and capital investment needs to help those businesses be successful and be able to grow, to be able to accommodate the demand of both meat consumers and producers that are raising the animals. Mm-hmm. And I think once we have the infrastructure available, I think we'll then see sort of this supply and demand kind of challenge. But then I think we'll see an increase in meat production and more farmers choosing to add meat to their animal and product portfolio. So it's a chicken and egg situation, but I really believe that we have some work to do in the skilled workforce arena, as well as the capital infrastructure to help this industry really succeed.
And Julie Beauvais, we are almost out of time, but if you could look ahead, say, 5 years from now, what would the state look like as far as having X amount of facilities for slaughtering and processing?
Boy, I wish I could hope that we have quite a bit more in the Verizon. And I'm hoping with our new program that we're launching this year with our Cooperative Interstate Shipment Program will allow more of our state facilities to maybe come on board, knowing that small facilities will be able to ship product over state lines and still remain under our state meat inspection program.
And Abby Willard, I'll give you the same opportunity to, you know, make a wish of what you'd like to see in Vermont 5 years from now, let's say, as far as the local meat industry.
Yeah, I'd love to see our farm and food community expand the meat production with the confidence that they can get their animals processed and slaughtered at facilities that are efficient, have a good flow, and have capacity to take on new customers so that we can continue to say that Vermont's demand for local meat is expanding and the supply is able to respond. So I think we've got some new facilities and some new operations sort of in the wings that we're excited to see open up and expand.
I think that would make Dave in Plainfield happy as well. Julie Bovaer is the Meat Program Section Chief. Abby Willard is Agriculture Development Division Director. I want to thank you both very much for being on this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
Sure thing. And CBS News is next. Then we'll be back with Interim Corrections Commissioner Jim Baker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
This is Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. On Sunday, a Vermont inmate incarcerated at the Tallahatchie County Correctional Facility in Mississippi died. He was 59-year-old Robert Vargas of Newport. That news comes after a staff member at the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility in South Burlington tested positive for COVID-19 last week. Needless to say, it's been another challenging week for our next guest, Interim Corrections Commissioner Jim Baker, who stepped into this position in January. Commissioner Baker, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint. I appreciate you being on the program today.
Thank you, Rick, and thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure thing. Listeners, if you've got a question or a comment for Corrections Commissioner Baker, you can give us a call at 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Some listeners may recognize your name, Jim Baker, but for those who don't, can you tell us a bit about where your career has taken you before this job?
Well, thanks for asking, Rick. I sometimes reflect on this, and it's hard for me to believe that I've been in some form in the justice system in Vermont since 1978.
Wow.
And that's when I started my career with the Vermont State Police in Bennington County. And I spent almost 31 years there, 10 days short of 31 years, when I retired from the State Police in 2009. I had the privilege to serve as the director of the state police and lead the fine men and women of the Vermont State Police. And then I spent a little bit of time at the Vermont Police Academy, the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council, for about a year and a half. Spent a little time as the administrator, acting chief of the Little Police Department of Manchester, Vermont, and then 3 years as the chief in Rutland, Vermont. And then I was in the Washington, D.C. area at a think tank nonprofit, the International Association of Chiefs of Police. I was on the executive staff there. And so, and then I find myself here at Corrections in the interim role.
Well, you've been filling this role since January of this year. Were you asked to fill the position, or is it something that that you sought out after Mike Touchette resigned?
No, I wasn't looking for a job. I was doing some consulting work and working on a small economic development project in my hometown of Arlington. And Secretary Mike Smith, the Human Services Secretary, reached out to ask me if I would serve in the interim role.
And are you interested in preparing to hand over the reins, or are you more interested in eliminating that interim title?
Well, I often joke with folks I keep the interim title because I do see myself as the interim commissioner of corrections. But I was only supposed to be here 120 days. It's supposed to be the end of April. And then this thing known as the COVID-19 pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. And it took all hands on deck in the Vermont Department of Corrections. And then finances got complicated. Budget process in the legislature got complicated. Building the budget for fiscal year 22 got complicated, and I'm still here, and I don't intend to be a permanent commissioner. When some of this settles down, the secretary and I will be talking about what a transition is going to look like.
Yeah. Since 2015, you're now the fourth person to hold this position. We've had Andy Pulido, Lisa Menard, and as I mentioned, Michael Touchette. Is this a really difficult job for someone to hold for a period of time?
It is. I've spent most of my career at the other end of the criminal justice system, on the front end of it, in law enforcement. It's where people enter the system. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that. I thought, Rick, that I had some idea what being the commissioner of the corrections is like. But it's another lesson in life about don't judge from the outside until you walk in another person's shoe or sit in their chair. And this is a very difficult job. The department's scrutinized heavily, both by the legislature and the public and the advocacy community. Mm-hmm. And we deal with a population that, in a lot of cases, folks don't want to deal with. There's not a lot of empathy on the outside. And the folks that we supervise, the community, and in the system have very complicated lives, and it's a very difficult job as the commissioner. But I also have to say, probably the more difficult jobs are the folks that are out there doing the work every day. They're incredible human beings that I've come to have a deep respect for, and it is a difficult job.
More difficult, more challenging than running the state police?
I believe so. I mean, I would think probably if my good friend Colonel Birmingham was listening, he'd probably have a different opinion. I ran the state police in a different time than the scrutiny that law enforcement's under right now. So, I don't want to compare that because I'm not in the seat that Colonel Birmingham's in right now.
Right. As I mentioned in the introduction, 59-year-old Roberto Vargas died over the weekend. He was one of just under 200 Vermont inmates that are housed at the private prison facility in Mississippi. What can you tell us about the cause or circumstances around the death so far?
Well, first of all, what I want to do, as I personally called his daughter to offer my condolences and promised her that we would work with her to get her dad's remains back to Vermont. These are not easy situations when we lose somebody in our custody. And right now, I don't have much more information than what we put out in the press release on Monday morning. We're waiting for results from an autopsy. At this point in time, it doesn't appear to be suspicious. We're in constant communication. I was just briefed before I got on by our director of the out-of-state unit, Dave Turner, about conversations that are ongoing with both the family and with the officials in Tallahatchie. And so I don't really have much more to report about what the cause is, Rick, at this point in time.
Do we have a timeline as to when we might be getting more information about that, Commissioner?
You know, we were in Vermont, and understanding how the medical examiner's office works in Vermont, I would venture a guess, Rick, but I don't understand Mississippi's system.
Right.
So it's hard for me to predict when that will come back. But, you know, we're going to stay on top of that. We've also, as a result of, a very heavily publicized death here in the system, in Vermont in December of 2019 have changed up the way we approach the review of the process internally of deaths. And that's applicable to an out-of-state death as well. And that process is ongoing now. There's an administrative process, a review of the medical process of how and what he was receiving for treatment in Mississippi. And then we'll ask for a third-party quality review of that care that was provided to him. If this turns out to be a medical event.
Mm-hmm. Now, the death you're referring to in December of last year was Kenneth Johnson at the Northern State Correctional Facility. And there was a report that came out after that death. So it said that more should have been done to care for Mr. Johnson. What's your reaction to the findings that were in that report?
Well, look, I before the report came out, I said that this was a death that was preventable. And not to point fingers at anybody, but if we have a moral and statutory obligation, which we do, to render care and safety to the folks that are in our custody, then we should never step back and think that we're doing everything we can any given day. And in that case, I've said it before, I believe that more could have been done, and I do not have any negative comments about the work that Downs, Racklin, and Martin did in the review of that death.
What is being done to ensure that the Kenneth Johnson situation isn't repeated, that the care that's needed is provided to a prisoner?
Well, first of all, the mere fact that we're willing to take a look at ourselves as an organization in that situation, do the hard look at ourselves. The fact that Secretary Smith asked for the outside review from Downs, Racklin, and Martin, and that report is back, is giving us feedback on what we should be doing. What we started doing is we are in the process of updating our death policy. It's almost done. We're working a little bit closer in collaboration with our medical provider, taking a look at cases where there's critical, if someone shows up and they're requiring critical acute care, then there's a review process going on of those cases on a regular basis with our director of nursing. Plus, we brought on a part-time medical director, Dr. Scott Strenio, who's providing that oversight in those kind of cases where there's acute care that's required. And we have quite a few folks in our custody that require acute, ongoing medical care.
Let's take a call now from Don, who's in Elmore. Don, thanks for calling Vermont Viewpoint. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Commissioner, you must have started in the state police about the time my old friend Glenn Davis retired. But
it wasn't too far after when Major Davis retired, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've heard your name around there before. But you're talking about the prisoner that died in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And this is an issue that has troubled me for years. I'm a law and order person, but I'm just amazed that putting people in prisons out of state so far from home hasn't been adjudicated in the federal court at this point as a violation of their rights when you're putting them so far from home. To me, that's abuse of the system. Part of trying to rehabilitate anybody, I think, requires them to have reasonable access for their families. And somebody here in Vermont isn't likely to be very able to visit a family member or friend or whatever who's imprisoned 1,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I come from on that. I'd like to hear what you think about it.
Great, Don. That's an excellent point. I know a lot of Vermonters have that same concern. And Commissioner Baker, we have seen the number of prisoners that we send out of state drop. You can probably update us with how many are now in Mississippi, and then explain why we continue this practice.
Sure. Thanks, Rick. And Don, that's a great question, great comments. I couldn't agree with you more. I don't think there's anybody that I know that I've had a conversation with or dealt with including leaders at the legislature or Governor Scott, who feel that this is good policy to have people out of state for many of the same reasons that you talked about. Again, coming in at this end of the system, as I said earlier, I'm starting to understand the impact of the jail system on our ability to be able to rehabilitate folks. And that's what the Vermont Department of Corrections focuses, is to take folks that are incarcerated and take them from incarceration from an act that they committed to bringing them back to the community to have them be good citizens. And it's challenging when you have folks out of state. So I just to make a point to this, you know, when I came into corrections in January, we had 265 people out of state. Mm-hmm. We now have 195. And to even give it more perspective, back in January of 2011, almost 10 years ago, there were 562 people out of state. And we've slowly whittled that down. The Department of Corrections has slowly whittled that down. I mean, some of that's to do with changes the legislature have made. But there is a focus on trying to whittle that population down and get them back. One of our biggest impediments right now is COVID.
Yeah.
We have to keep beds freed up in every facility in the state for the purposes of quarantine. And if we have a major outbreak, we have to make swift and quick judgment about isolating people that may be positive to knock down the spread in the jails. And, you know, we're making tough decisions that are having impacts on other parts of the system in order to keep our system clean from the virus. And I got to give a call to the staff that works at corrections right now. We are one of the cleanest systems in the country. And the reason why that's happening is because of the work that the individuals are doing inside corrections every day to make adjustments to keep our facilities clean.
There's a new process that you've been working on to investigate deaths in the prison. So where are we as far as that new process?
Well, it's in draft form right now, and it's a new policy directive on how we respond to deaths inside facilities. But it also includes deaths that may not be in a facility. But, for example, if someone is on furlough and still under our supervision in the community, we're expanding to take a look at that, too. Because in a lot of cases, this comes back to substance abuse, mental health, and so on. And it's helping us identify gaps that may be in our ability to transition people out of jail. So right now it's in draft form. But as a result of that being in draft form, we're not waiting to implement certain parts of that process, which I described earlier.
In August, you told lawmakers that you were shocked at the level of sexualization among the Department of Corrections workforce. Without getting explicit, can you talk about what was going on with the department's culture?
Well, look, I'm going to start this by saying, which sometimes I fail to recognize this, and it's important that employees hear this. The vast majority of the people that are working in the Vermont Department of Corrections are some of the most hardworking, empathetic, courageous people that I've met in my career. What I was seeing and what I sometimes continue to see is a culture where lines get blurred and relationships get blurred, and people make bad decisions based on that. And relationships and or comments and conversations break out that are inappropriate for the workplace.
So having seen that, what steps have been taken? You know, what has been happening since you know, that came to your attention?
Well, Rick, you know, you kind of went through what my career has been prior to getting corrections, and I don't know how this happens, but I find myself in these situations in interim roles more than once, and I'm a firm believer that, you know, bad news, it's not like fine wine. It doesn't get better with time, and the sooner you acknowledge that you have a challenge, the sooner you can start the conversation inside an organization about those challenges. So that was the first step. And that conversation's ongoing now, and people are openly talking about it. I have staff members reaching out directly to me. I have former staff members reaching out to me directly. I have loved ones of staff members reaching out to me, talking to me about the challenges around what it's like to work the front line in corrections. And so we're starting to understand that picture. Our leadership team understands what their roles are, and we're starting to address those issues. And much of it's through conversation. Some of it's through investigative practices and resulting discipline. Some of it is we've brought in an outside consulting firm, the Moss Group, which is helping us work through the culture. And we have two projects going on in the state that are directly related to culture inside the institutions. So there's a lot going on. And, you know, where we are right now in this conversation is that I'm very content and happy with where it is. People are openly talking about maybe historical relationships and the way they were treated. And there's a clear explanation for this for me and how these cultures form inside organizations. Doing the jobs that these folks do, as I said earlier, are extremely stressful. Just before I came on the air, I got briefed about an assault overnight of a corrections officer in one of our facilities where it required medical attention. And, it's a very, very tough job to do, and sometimes the culture is a way of letting that stress out. But at the end of the day, it's not helpful. And then the final piece that we've done is we've bolstered our peer support team, and we've also brought in an outside clinician to help with issues around stress, resiliency, and in situations like an assault, our practice is now that immediately the officer's out on administrative leave. They meet with our clinician. We're obviously worried about their medical situation, but we're also wrapping these other services around them to help reduce the stress.
These are serious things that need to be addressed and need to be addressed immediately. I don't want to beat this drum too much, but with the interim tag that you have, interim commissioner, do you have the juice to make the all of the changes that really need to be made within corrections right now?
Listen, Rick, I'm laughing because juice is a term that I often use with my staff. If any of them are listening right now, they're probably just shaking their heads. Look, I think in some way, look, I kid about it. And if you go back to my days in Rutland, and Chris Morris was the mayor at the time, and I used to kid with him about the term of interim police chief. I don't want to sound callous, and I don't want to sound egotistic, but when you don't, I wasn't looking for a job when Secretary Smith called me. I came here because there was a need. I love the state of Vermont. The state's been good to me and my family. I felt like I had something I could give. And I've had some challenges in my life that presented people stepped up and helped me out in a big way, and this is a way for me to pay back. But in an interim role, and again, I don't want to sound callous when I'm about ready to say, but I don't have to worry about if someone's going to like Jim Baker or not. What I have to worry about is what I do every day when I wake up. I'm doing the right thing for the employees inside the Vermont Department of Corrections who need a cheerleader, and they need someone to have their back, but they also have to have someone that's going to hold them accountable in a way that's respectful, with dignity. And one of the things that I've learned about corrections is that sometimes they become the punching bag in the system. And, in an interim role, I can push back. And it doesn't really matter who I push back against, Rick, because if I think I'm doing the right thing to help the organization move forward, and if someone isn't happy with that, then I can go back to where I was before I came here.
Gotcha. We're going to take another break for CBS News Update, and then we're going to return with Corrections Commissioner Jim Baker. He's here with us till 11 o'clock. If you'd like to call in, our numbers are 244-1777. You can also reach us at 877-291-8255. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Jim Baker has served as the head of the Vermont State Police after the resignation of Corrections Commissioner Michael Touchette a year ago. Baker was named the interim Corrections Commissioner. He has joined us this morning to discuss the many issues facing his department. And listeners, our numbers are 244-1777, also 877-291-8255. If you'd like to ask our guest, Corrections Commissioner Jim Baker, a question, or if you have a comment for him, you can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Commissioner, you told a committee of lawmakers last month that there's a staffing crisis within the department, but the problem isn't just recruitment. So what is the issue there, and how are you trying to fix that?
Yeah, I did brief the legislature, Rick, on the issue of retention of employees. And I'm primarily talking about the line staff coming into our six correctional facilities, the corrections officers. It's a priority, and it's been really a focus as a result of the pandemic and the stress that staff is under. It was stressful enough before, but with this pandemic and we're testing staff every 2 weeks now for the virus. We're testing every facility every 6 weeks. That in itself is stressful. And, the fear of contracting the virus and bringing it home to your family. And I think these are making the situation a little more challenging than before. But what I've discovered after being here is we don't have a problem hiring people. We have a problem retaining people. And there's a lot of layers to that. It kind of goes back to what I talked about earlier. You asked me about my comments at the State House about sexualization. I've spent time talking to the leadership about the way we interact with each other and what those interactions and transactions are like and how we treat staff. One of the things that I've learned over the years being in leadership positions are that when folks leave an organization, chances are they're not leaving the organization. They're leaving a leader. And so leadership plays a big part in this. Supporting the staff plays a big part in it. People need to know that people care for them and they're looking out for them and we have their best interest at heart. And I think we're doing a lot of work around recruitment and hiring the right folks, but also putting processes in place to support them. And the next focus for us is on developing our mid-manager leaders. Tomorrow we're holding a virtual commissioners leadership summit where we've got some guest speakers coming in from the outside to talk about leadership, and we're starting to focus on that in order for us to make the connection between good leadership, good care of our employees, and retaining those employees, because they do very important work under very trying circumstances. And we need to do more to make sure we're retaining people. And we're getting a lot of our information from, we're actually reaching out for folks that have left to find out why they left. Mm. And we're getting a pretty good picture of what that looks like.
It is a difficult, and use the word trying, job. I can't imagine doing the work that these individuals do. Who would be a good candidate for a job there? Sell me on taking a position in one of these facilities.
Well, I mean, first of all, who would be a good candidate is someone that understands that the people that we supervise, they may not have had the same opportunities in life that the rest of us have had. And, there's got to be a level of empathy and dignity and respect for the individuals. We have to understand that we have an obligation that they're in our custody, and that their safety and welfare is in our best interest. people that can work in a team environment, people that know how to take care of themselves and be resilient, and also understand that coming into corrections can be a career. Can we pay people more coming in? Here's the interesting thing. I haven't heard anybody say to me yet, or I haven't gotten any feedback yet, that the reason why they left is because the money and the benefits were not good enough. Hmm. Should we be paying corrections officers more? That's a fair conversation. But, I think that's what we're looking for, and we're looking for people that want a career. And the other piece of it is, we sit inside the Agency of Human Services, and, it's an entry point into the career of human services, because that's what we do. And we do have a security side. We do have a bit of an enforcement side. But the majority of what we do is programming and treatment and providing opportunities for people for rehabilitation. So what I often say to people that I've talked to, hey, consider a career in corrections. You don't have to stay as a corrections officer your entire career. There's opportunities as probation and parole. We do daily work. There's a lot of work that goes behind the scenes on programming and education and so on. There's a lot of opportunities inside corrections to make a career.
Does this staffing situation, I'm going to get back to Don, our caller's point, does the staffing situation put more pressure on the state to continue to use facilities like the one we use in Mississippi right now?
I don't think it's as much staffing as a piece of it, Rick, but I think the bigger issue for us is our facilities and our capacity to hold folks. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't pretend to understand all the history here, but, there was a time back a few years ago when, the population, even when I came, we're about 300 below what the population was when I came almost a year ago. So some of it is simply because of what was overcrowding situations early on and taking inmates out of the state. Like I said, back in 2011, they had 562 people out of state. Right. So it's more about the way the system operates and so on than it is staffing. But staffing definitely plays a role in that.
We've brought that number down quite a bit, the out-of-state. How are we doing that? Are we offering conditional releases to many prisoners to bring that number down? How can that number be, so much lower than it was, 10 years ago?
I think it's a combination of things. I think that, first of all, there's a lot of work going on in the restorative justice area, diversion, the criminal justice centers around the state that we work in collaboration with do a lot of that good work. Legislative changes, the latest passing of Act 148, which is Criminal Justice Reinvestment 2, emphasizing a more robust community-based correctional system. These are all factors, I think, that are applying to it. And there's been work done by other folks in the criminal justice system to resentence individuals and so on. And I think collectively it's brought the number down significantly, which is no small feat, especially in the pandemic environment. It's allowed us to be very flexible in the way we manage the system right now to keep it clean.
Let's go back to the phones, and we'll take a call from Dave, who's joining us from Montpelier. Good morning, Dave. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Jim Baker, how do you do? My name is Dave Bellini. And
Dave, how are you?
Full disclosure, I've never actually met Jim or talked to him. And I was hired by the DOC in 1979, and I'm on my way out, if you will. I'll be retiring sometime in 21. But first, thank you for taking the most difficult job in state government. Yeah. It is a thankless task, and I want you to know you have my full support for everything you're trying to do. So I want to say that publicly and loudly.
Thank you, David.
It's such an enormous task, and the department, people think of it as sometimes unskilled labor, but it's not. It's really highly skilled labor, and it's a huge department in many ways. It takes on every issue of society. I did want to offer just something. I worked in a prison throughout the 1980s, and it wasn't a terrible job at all. And I really think that filling the vacant positions is difficult, and I don't think it can be done without someone saying to the administration, to Phil Scott, and to the legislature, and to the powerful people on the committees, this probably isn't going to happen without some cost and without some expense. And we could spend hours talking about, you know, what should happen and what changes we should make. I think you're on the right track. But I just want to point out one other thing. In 1978, I was given a civil service exam. I was given a psychological test before I could sign on as a CO1. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of gone away. And if I wanted a promotion, you had to take a test and you had to be interviewed. And the last thing I want to say is there are other states like Rhode Island, California, New Jersey, where they're not experiencing the hiring problems that we are, or people leaving. And there's some benchmarking that could be done. What are those states doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
a lot of it's money.
Dave, I'm going to thank you so much for that call. That was great. Any of the points that he made that you wanted to address?
Yeah, first of all, Rick, I want to... Dave is a longtime employee of the Vermont Department of Corrections. I don't know exactly how long without doing a little bit of research, but I think he's probably between 35 and 40 years, I'm guessing. Mm. And so I want to publicly acknowledge that career. Today I'll be acknowledging four or five other employees who are retiring, who've dedicated their lives to the Vermont Department of Corrections, and Dave is one of them. And I think the other thing I want to acknowledge about Dave is that he's been very involved over the years with the Vermont State Employees Association, the union that represents the rank and file and other employees inside corrections. And, you know, I think his comments that he made come from that viewpoint, and I appreciate that. And I have a different approach than some folks may do with relationships with organized labor. And as an example, tomorrow I've invited some of the representatives of the corrections bargaining unit to participate in the leadership training. So we're on the same page and we're pulling in the same direction.
All right.
With that said, Rick, you know, he makes some good points. In fact, we are in the process of a major overhaul of the hiring process to include some of the things that Dave referred to when he applied in 1978. I don't know where that changed along the way, but I do think part of the tension is a better process of screening folks, because in some cases the job just is not met for the individual we hired. And so we're trying to do a better job. We're trying to raise the bar. And I think that part of that is gaining public's confidence and other folks' confidence, because the folks that do this work deserve respect, and sometimes they don't get it.
As a small history note, he brought up the civil service exam. It was none other than Vermont's Chester A. Arthur who signed that into law when he was president of the United States. That's how everybody knows that now. All right, Jim. So last week you had a staff member test positive at the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility. That's the women's prison in South Burlington. We learned since that there were no additional cases at the facility. But I wonder if you could talk us through the department's handling of something like that.
Look, this has been one of the most phenomenal things that I've had the privilege to witness, is the way we built the system since I think it was March 13th when the governor declared the first state of emergency. It's been an unbelievable thing to watch, and the level of dedication and teamwork inside corrections has been unbelievable. So what happens now is, if you remember back in April, we had a fairly significant outbreak in Northwest of a number of inmates and a number of staff. And from that, we built a system that when we get a positive staff member or an inmate, there's an immediate response by emergency response team that includes tracers. And those tracers go into interviewing the individuals that are positive. We take a look at video. We watch who they had contact with, and we immediately start reacting to that so we can shut down the spread of the virus inside the facilities. And I wish I could take credit for this, but I can't. It's the folks that have put this together were given the green light to go ahead and respond to this, and they've done an unbelievable job. We have one of the cleanest jail systems in the country. And I say that with a great deal of pride for the people that are doing the work every day, right down to the corrections officers inside the facility that are making sure that the inmate cleaning crews are cleaning and keeping our facilities clean, wearing masks, putting on protective gear, following the protocols that we put in place, which are guided by the Vermont Department of Health and the CDC. And so when we get a positive like that, it's almost routine now, the way people respond to include the tracing teams.
Well, I want to continue with the facility there in South Burlington. A year ago, there was an investigation by 7 days, found evidence of abuse, but also charges of poor sanitation. So what has been done to correct those problems at the Chittenden Regional Correctional Facility?
So, look, on the sanitation piece, right, I have a saying, it's hard to bust a sneaker. And that building has outlived its usefulness. And we do have a study going on right now to start looking at what a new women's facility will look like, in the 21st century. That building is not built for the kind of work that we do with the women who are in our custody, from programming to privacy to the ability for them to meet with their family and their children. And so we need to take a look at the building. In the meantime, I believe that the staff at Chittenden, under the leadership of Superintendent Teresa Messier and her team there, along with Buildings and General Services, who is our landlord technically, are doing everything they can to keep that building clean. And, we've had problems with drainage there, and they continue to try to work on it. So some of what you heard for feedback around the sanitary conditions was around showers backing up and so on.
Right.
And folks are focused on that. I mean, none of that's going to get completely eliminated until we get out of that building.
And COVID isn't that other issue that we brought up at Chittenden Regional. And we had that outbreak down at Tallahatchie in Mississippi, a bit out of our purview. But what steps have been taken to make sure that we don't have that happening with our prisoners there?
First of all, we're in the process of testing now. And testing's been ongoing. And tests are coming back negative. Don't hold me to this because I know it's somewhere in my notes here, but we just did testing within the last couple of weeks, and I believe there were 9 individuals that were positive, but they were all positives from prior testing. So they were in the original group. As far as prevention goes, we have insisted that Core Civic, who is the contractor that runs the facility, follows our protocols. We insisted that they give our team back here that tracks the out-of-state unit access via camera. So we have remote access now to cameras so we can see what's going on and make sure protocols are being followed. We sent staff down there. And I have a direct line with the CEO of Core Civic. In fact, I just got a call back from one of their executive team leaders the other day on the death of Mr. Vargas. And excuse me. We have that kind of communication going on, and we're asking them to be at a higher standard than they were before because of COVID. And remember, where they're situated in Mississippi is one of the highest spread rates in the country, and Mississippi itself has a very high number of positive cases every day.
We only have about 30 seconds left, so I hate to ask a big question, but what is your commitment, Jim Baker, to the men and women who are in our correction system and to the people working in the correction system?
Look, in 30 seconds, I think if you ask that question of them, I would hope this is what they say, Rick, is that, number one, I care about them. Number two, I'm fighting for them every day. Number three, I have to balance that with accountability and expectations of behavior that's professional. And the vast majority of the employees that I have met are incredible human beings doing work every day that a lot of folks would not do. And I can't tell you how proud I am of them.
Jim Baker is Vermont's Interim Corrections Commissioner. Commissioner Baker, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Rick, and have a great day.
You too. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs, directed by Danny McKivrigan, and our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can feel free to suggest topics or guests. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next here on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.